That's one thing that's really frustrating about mycotoxins is that they are very stable and persistent. So once they're there, they tend to be there throughout, but you can have new additional accumulation of toxins occur even in storage. So that's where, again, you know, if you do some of the fresh green chop testing, I would highly recommend doing a test once it's fermented and you start to feed it out for sure.
We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible.
Did you know that beta-carotene deficiency can affect fertility rates and reproductive performance? Victus Transition from DSM Firmenich provides beta-carotene to help your cattle fertility rates. With early detection in health, reproduction, and feeding, SmaxTech future-proofs your dairy operation. Priority IAC, the only company bringing the fields of microbiology and nutrition together. Adiseo USA, producers of SmartAmine M and MilkPay.com. Modern solutions for modern cows with AHV. Contact us to beat biofilm-related issues in your herd.
Hello, welcome back to the Dairy Podcast Show brought to you by Wisenetics. My name is Barry Bradford from Michigan State University. And today I'm very happy to welcome to the show Dr. Paige Gott. Thanks for joining us today, Paige.
Thanks for having me, Barry.
So Dr. Gott is a senior technical manager for ruminants for the Animal Nutrition and Health Division of DSM Firmenich in North America. Tell us a little bit about the company, Paige. Like, what does your company do? What do you guys specialize in?
Yeah, so most people hopefully recognize the DSM name on the vitamin and carotenoid side. And we also have four premix plants in North America and globally. You know, we're a global company. Our main headquarters currently are in the Netherlands. And then we also have kind of our animal nutrition and health hubs in Switzerland and then also in Austria. I came to DSM, I guess, 2022 officially as part of the Biomin acquisition. I had been a technical manager with Biomin prior to DSM acquiring us. And so that's why we have our location, our research center still in Austria is, you know, the legacy Biomin portion of the business was incorporated into DSM. So yeah, known on the vitamin side, and we have various other feed additives. We play in the mycotoxin risk management space. We have some phytogenic or essential oil products. And yeah, that's kind of the bulk of what we do, especially on the ruminant side in North America.
And in your role, Paige, what does a typical week look like, if there is such a thing?
There's not really a lot of interactions with our sales team internally, supporting our sales team and customers, a lot of interactions with customers. Yesterday was a crazy day, for example, that my phone kept ringing with customers reaching out with you know, technical questions are usually how I support. I manage all of our dairy mycotoxin results. So I send out those reports to our customers that are submitting those. So I get a lot of follow-up interactions with customers having questions on the mycotoxin results. But just in general, we have a pretty lean team, especially in North America. So because there's a few of us, we interact with a lot of the customers. So I support all of the US and Canada, which is fairly big territory, but it's great because I get to see, you know, people from all over, all the different segments of the industry and, you know, how people do things. And Western Canada is different, you know, than here in Ohio, and farms in the Southwest are different. So I do enjoy that aspect to be able to support such a large territory, to have that exposure and interactions with a diverse, you know, all of the industry basically in North America.
Yeah, so getting to travel across diverse range of locations, is there one or two dairy visits that come to mind as something that was like, oh, I didn't expect this, or I hadn't been to a dairy kind of setup like this before? Does anything come to mind?
The first time that I was in the Southeast was different. You know, I'm in Ohio. Most of my experience prior to joining the company was in the Midwest. So the farms in the South are quite a bit different. And having palm trees, you know, on the farm was one of the things I laughed about, that I, one, had never seen a palm tree before, but then to see it on a dairy farm was kind of humorous to me. So you definitely see different housing systems, different ingredients in the diet. I get questions sometimes about, you know, carrot waste or various vegetables, things that we don't necessarily see or feed here in Ohio and what I was exposed to. So, you know, some of the stuff out west in California, it's like, I don't know, there's potential for mycotoxins in it. Definitely if it has nutritive value that can support fungal growth, there's a risk there, but I don't know what specifically you might find in some of those ingredients just because we haven't really tested it or looked at it before to know. So
absolutely. Yeah.
You never know what samples are going to get submitted of what people are feeding. That's always interesting.
Beta carotene can impact reproductive performance in cattle. Because the main sources of beta carotene are forages, most cattle don't get enough. Victus Transition from DSM Firmenich contains a blend of beta carotene and mixed tocopherols, which provide needed vitamin A and antioxidants. Victus Transition fed cattle have better fertility rates and improved colostrum quality. Make sure your cattle get the beta carotene they need with Victus Transition. Visit dsm-firmenich.com/victustransition.
Absolutely. Yeah, so let's dig into that. That's kind of a big chunk of what you focus on now, right, is mycotoxins. And there's a lot of people out there who are all too familiar with that. But for those who maybe don't have as much exposure or haven't thought about it too much, maybe help us understand what is a mycotoxin in the first place.
Yeah, mycotoxins are secondary fungal metabolites. So they're compounds that various fungi can synthesize. The reasoning behind why the fungus produces the mycotoxins, there's some different theories on that, one of which is that it's a stress response. When that fungus is stressed, they can release those compounds potentially as defense mechanism. There's different reasons why they can release those compounds. Some of them, they are thought to help with penetration into the plant, so to damage the plant cell wall to give that fungus more access to colonize and, you know, set up shop, so to speak, to access those nutrients. So different reasons why the fungi would produce them, but they're not essential for that mold to grow and survive. So the mold isn't necessarily always synthesizing mycotoxins. It's generally thought, again, to be more of a stress response or in certain climatic conditions and scenarios where that mold will produce those compounds.
To check out the mycotoxin survey provided by DSM Firmenich, visit dsm-firmenich.com/mycotoxin-survey.
And I know there's always a lot of discussion about different types of mycotoxins. How are those formed? Is it different situations, different funguses?
Yeah, there's a diverse array of mycotoxins. Looking at the literature, you'll see anywhere from a few hundred to over 1,000 mycotoxins have been identified and described. The variation you see does come from different molds. There's different types of fungi that produce different toxins, have a different toxin profile. Definitely the climatic conditions, like I mentioned, the weather factors are really big into influencing those molds and where they can grow and survive, and then also what toxins they may produce. So that's why we do see regional differences in contamination patterns, types of contamination, and different molds or diseases can vary regionally because of the weather factor to it. Different substrates support different molds, that they're, you know, a good resource for nutrients for certain type of molds, but others can't colonize that type of ingredient or crop necessarily. So there's a lot of factors that influence whether or not those molds can produce the toxins. But in the scheme of things, you know, there are many molds that exist, but relatively few actually are known or associated with producing mycotoxins. So we generally think kind of the big three molds are the Fusarium molds, which are associated with production typically in the field prior to harvest. Aspergillus molds are one that a lot of people recognize because they synthesize aflatoxins among many other potential mycotoxins, but aflatoxins are really heavily regulated, so most people are familiar with them. And then the Penicillium molds are another type that are pretty well associated with producing mycotoxins. That's not to say those are the only types of molds that do or can produce those compounds, but those are kind of the main three that we look at. But definitely It's a very hot topic, and there's a lot of ongoing research. So we're constantly learning more about the molds and the toxins and where to find them and what influences them and what effects they have. And the combination of toxins can result in different outcomes in the animal. So there's always something new, really, to learn in the field of mycotoxins.
Thanks. Yeah, that makes sense. And I know when I talk to people who are, you know, much bigger experts on the topic than me, you know, they'll talk about all the different thousands of mycotoxins you mentioned, but unfortunately, a lot of them, we don't have any data on whether they impact the animals or not, or what interactions there might be. So I'm curious, since you said you guys do lab analyses from field samples, what's the approach taken there? Do you guys do a lot of analyses or kind of focus in on those three major groupings?
Yeah, we have kind of our default panel of mycotoxins that we look for here in North America, which is 18 different metabolites. They're some of the better known, most studied and understood, known to have detrimental effects in the animal. So, you know, there's a panel of aflatoxins, fumonisins, the trichothecines, which would be a big family that includes deoxynivalenol or vomitoxin in related metabolites, as well as T2 toxin in related metabolites that most people are familiar with. It also includes ochratoxin A and zearalenone. And so that's kind of a, I'm going to call it basic, because you can definitely screen for less than that. You know, some people look for individual toxins, but in my opinion, our panel is kind of the basic things that we know can occur and cause issues and maybe have some regulations that go along with them. So that's why we look at those. But we do have several other extended panel options where we can look, you know, domestically through our partners at Romer Labs. We have a panel that looks for over 50 different metabolites. So it includes all the common ones, plus some other emerging mycotoxins that maybe are associated, you know, have some association with causing issues or negative consequences in animals, but we don't know as much about them yet. Or there's also some ergot alkaloids that are included in that panel, which I feel like sometimes we overlook those since they're generally associated with small grains and some forages, grasses can have ergot alkaloid compounds in them, but they're not typically thought of being present in corn-based ingredients. So since we feed a lot of corn here in the States, maybe, you know, we're not always having the ergot at top of mind, but it's something that we can look for as well, since we know those can be detrimental. And then we do have an option to send samples overseas to our research center and collaborators at the IFA Thun in Austria, where they can screen for over 700 or 800 different metabolites at this point. They're really the leading researchers when it comes to the analytical chemistry side of mycotoxins and identifying those compounds. And that panel includes more than just mycotoxins. There's some other plant metabolites and phytoestrogens and other things that are included as well that we know can potentially have some detrimental effects, but we don't necessarily know everything about. So we usually reserve that for real troubleshooting odd scenarios where we've ruled out a lot of other potential causes of the issues. And then that's kind of the, we'll find something. We don't necessarily know how to interpret that or what level is that concentration an issue, but it gives us somewhere to go to try to hone in on and look into what literature exists and understand, you know, how that maybe could be playing into the issues that we're seeing on farm.
Well, you mentioned we typically, obviously, we feed between corn grain and corn silage. It's a big chunk of our diets for the vast majority of dairies in the U.S., and so often that ends up being the focus of mycotoxin investigation. So maybe talk about that a little bit. Is that typically what you see as the main source of contamination, or do you sometimes see other things as a major source?
Yeah, usually, you know, corn silage is a big one that we look at because it tends to make up a large portion of the diet. So it's not just that it's you know, fed frequently, it's fed in higher concentration. So if there is contamination there, it could really pose a huge challenge being a large portion of the diet. Definitely the corn grain, sometimes people get hung up on that because they associate corn grain with mycotoxins. So they want to screen that. But if it's only, you know, 10, 12% of the diet, I always ask the question, you know, what's the other 90%, because we know that pretty much anything, like I said, can be contaminated with mycotoxins. So I think something that maybe has been underestimated as a potential risk are some of the forages. You know, usually think of the grain being a good source of nutrients to support that mold growth, but we do see contamination on the forage side as well. You know, something that we spend a lot of time on, and it's kind of my soapbox. I like to get on to talk about straw as a potential source of contamination, and also the fact that we tend to feed straw in our pre-fresh cows and some of those animals that are highly susceptible to mycotoxins because they're already dealing with a multitude of other stressors. So then when you add mycotoxins into the mix, that's another thing that those animals are having to deal with and cope with. So they tend to be highly susceptible to those challenges. So trying to, you know, keep that in mind anytime we're troubleshooting issues. What kind of ingredients are in the diet? Are you feeding maybe some co-products? Because the corn co-products especially, I think most people realize distillers, grains, and even corn gluten products can be, tend to be contaminated. But even like wheat mids and small grains co-products and small grains themselves can be contaminated. And not just with the ergot alkaloids that I mentioned, we also find the DON, the zearalenone, those traditional, you know, mycotoxins in those ingredients as well.
So a lot of things to think about looking at a whole diet, right?
Yes.
And sometimes is it useful to first just screen a TMR, or does that have some complications?
That's usually what I would recommend, especially if you're using one of the more advanced testing analytical types options like liquid chromatography with tandem mass spectrometry. Those methods are usually validated for a more complex matrix like a TMR, or even a corn silage for that matter. If you're trying to do some quick test options like we have that are available for, you know, use in the field or even at the grain elevator level, those are probably not going to be your best option. There are some kits that can be potentially utilize in other ingredients beyond your raw commodities, but definitely the TMR when you're troubleshooting issues is what I recommend to start with to get that overall picture of what the cows are eating. So we're not missing something that maybe is a relatively small inclusion, but could be really highly contaminated. So it could inflate those overall concentrations, but yeah, there are some challenges with a TMR just when it comes to the analytical side. So you need to make sure that you're using the right method to be able to hopefully get reliable data back out of that testing process that you've gone through.
Thanks. Yeah. Well, we're talking in late August, and of course, most people on dairy farms and dairy nutritionists are starting to look ahead to the next month or so as we're putting up the next corn silage crop and anticipating what that's going to be like when we start feeding it. That's always a million-dollar question going into late part of the year as we transition from last year's silage to this year's. So do you have any sort of advanced insight for us to give us some ideas of what we might anticipate, especially in terms of mycotoxins this year?
Yeah, so normally I internally, and then I write articles that go into our e-newsletter talking about kind of prediction. It's unofficial. It's me compiling weather information. I look at some of the foliar disease maps that are out there from some of the seed companies that have resources like that, you know, any sort of weather event type information. And I try to put together my crystal ball. I joke that it's a magic eight ball because there's a lot of uncertainty and a lot of variation because of the high variability in the weather factors. But, you know, there's a lot of other things that play into that. So the weather obviously is huge, but, you know, tillage type and depth plays a role, the hybrids and the varieties of the crops that you're dealing with, weed and insect pressure, anything that damages that plant makes it more susceptible. So that's where I like to look at hail events or wind events. If there's ever, you know, unfortunately, derecho events that blow through places, and try to understand some of those types of situations that maybe have made the crop more susceptible in those areas. because that really opens up the plant to be colonized by the different fungal diseases. Plus the foliar diseases, you know, a lot of people get hung up on tar spot and some of the other foliar diseases, which those are not associated, you know, with producing mycotoxins, but they do reduce plant health and can make them more susceptible to some of the mycotoxigenic mold. So I kind of take all of that in combination and try to roll it into a prediction, rough prediction of what we might see. I think this year is interesting, just the variation in different parts of the country. You know, I live in Ohio and my husband is a grain farmer. So we started spring wet and cold. Crops here were later getting in the ground, but when the conditions were right, it was a short period of time that everything, you know, pretty much went in. Obviously there was some stragglers and later planting that occurred, but then it became dry. So yesterday we were joking, my husband was doing a rain dance and he left the windows down in his truck and stuff in the bed of his truck, hoping to get it to rain, which we did get a little bit of rain last night, but we're still on the dry end. So, you know, it's really important to keep in mind your local weather conditions and what you've experienced, because there is so much variation. And I think one of the benefits on the ruminant side is because we do have local forages, typically that you do know where your feed is coming from for the bulk of what's being fed. So you have a better indication. Whereas, you know, when corn is hauled in or railed in, you might not know where that corn came from exactly and what conditions it was exposed to. But generally, you know, the hotter, drier climates are more susceptible to toxins like fumonisins. Or one that we'll see in hotter areas. Definitely aflatoxins. Most people, you know, think of aflatoxins, but those are generally in the Midwest associated as storage mycotoxins. But in southern regions, they do occur in the field, so they can come in with the crop from the get-go. So keeping that in mind, if you're feeding, you know, maybe some cotton seed or, you know, citrus byproducts, things that were grown in other climates, that they could bring in a different toxin profile just because of the variation from a regional perspective. The Fusarium mold that produces the trichothecene, so your vomitoxin, zearalenone, other trichothecenes, and potentially fumonisins, you know, is generally thought to be more of a more temperate, cooler climate and wet condition situation where you see it. So I often talk to people about, you know, what were the weather conditions when the corn was tasseling? Because that's a very susceptible time frame for the plant to, you know, pick up those infections. So if it was happened to be cool and rainy time frame, or if it was hot and dry, I mean, there's just so many factors that go into it. But I think this year, I shouldn't say this because then people hold me to it, but I think this year maybe is set up to be more challenging, especially in areas that perhaps the last couple of years haven't had as much a mycotoxin challenge, just because of some of that variation in the weather. I know Wisconsin, eastern Wisconsin, has gotten a lot of rain recently, where some of the parts were dry early on. Again, we were wet early on and now we've been dry. Ohio was under some pretty extreme drought conditions for the most part last year, so the Don wasn't as big of a challenge like it has been historically. Ohio tends to be a hot spot for Don and even zearalenone, and we didn't see that quite to the same extent in 2024 crop, but I think this year there's more potential for that again. But yeah, it really depends on the local climate, and even within a single field you can have variation in the contamination. If you have, you know, high dry areas versus low lying wet areas, there can be those micro climates or micro environments that set up that crop for contamination, whereas it might not be throughout, but there are parts of the field and the crop that could be contaminated potentially. So I don't have a good answer yet. I'm working on some articles that will be released this fall, so you can always check back with us and get a look at my magic eight ball when it comes to contamination. But yeah, it's still pretty early. We have a few new crop samples that have come into the lab just this past week. So hopefully we'll start to get some indication. But again, it really depends on where you're at and where that crop came from is that such a big influence on the contamination?
To sign up for monthly mycotoxin survey updates along with mycotoxin-related articles provided by DSM Firmenich, subscribe here. dsm-firmenich.com/subscribe.
Okay, so if I'm a consultant or a dairy producer and I've walked some fields and I've seen some noticeable molds, does it make sense to sort of grab some samples as silage is getting packed and sending those in for analysis so I get some heads up on exactly what mix of mycotoxins I may be dealing with in the next couple months?
Yeah, sure. You can definitely do some preliminary screening on the, you know, the fresh green shot prior to fermentation. It'll give you some indication of what's coming in from the field, which tends to be the bulk of what we see, you know, based on that kind of basic panel of most common concerning mycotoxins that we know the most about. I would do that maybe as a introductory testing to it, but then I would look at it once it's been fermented and you start to feed it out. I would resample again because there is the potential for that contamination profile to change. Generally, we don't think of fermentation or really any of the normal processing that we can do that retains nutritive value in the plant as reducing mycotoxin levels. That's one thing that's really frustrating about mycotoxins is that they are very stable and persistent. So once they're there, they tend to be there throughout, but you can have new additional accumulation of toxins occur even in storage. So that's where, again, you know, if you do some of that fresh green shot testing, I would highly recommend doing a test once it's fermented and you start to feed it out for sure.
One other question on this. So, I mean, a lot of people mostly are talking about mature cows when they're digging into mycotoxin contamination. Maybe they see some gut health issues or some transition cow problems or something. But what about young stock? Is that a concern?
Yeah, definitely. You know, the calves and heifers can be impacted as well. I mentioned wheat mids earlier. It's been a few years, but we did a little kind of mini wheat mid survey a few years ago looking at contamination, and those can be highly contaminated. And a lot of times when you think about the calf grains and starters, there tends to be a fairly high inclusion rate of that. Oats, obviously corn, other ingredients that we do feed to those animals can be contaminated. So it's definitely a potential risk. You know, if you're seeing animals are having a hard time transitioning from being milk fed onto those dry ingredients and starters and whatnot, it might be something to look at that maybe there's some contamination there, because that could definitely influence their transition to the dry feed. Obviously, we think a lot of the gastrointestinal effects, but with mycotoxins, but most of the mycotoxins are detrimental to the immune system and immune function as well. So that can open the door for respiratory issues or other non-GI issues, but even, you know, some of the Salmonella and E. coli, the other GI bugs, it also opens the door for those to really get to the calves and do more harm. If you didn't have a mycotoxin issue, it can definitely amplify that when you do have mycotoxin pressure, even at not extreme crazy levels. Those lower levels of contamination can still be a predisposing factor for other diseases and challenges. So definitely something to consider in the calves and the young stock. Even, you know, I mentioned straw earlier, you know, I think of straw as a bedding in some of those younger animals, and we do see them eating it. So it could be that that's a source as well, beyond just what we're intentionally feeding them. Some of the other things that they might consume could pose a challenge as well.
I'm also curious, as many heifers as are raised in the southern high plains now, and I know I've been on some of those heifer yards, and part of the way they get inexpensive gains is with like gin trash, right, or cotton burrs. Have you guys analyzed a lot of those? I'm always curious if that's a mycotoxin source.
No, not a lot. I know we did a few samples early on, and I don't think they weren't as bad as I thought they would be. But again, that could be a year to year, the variation depending on the weather conditions. So yes, anything like I said, could potentially be a source of contamination. So if the cows aren't doing as well as you think they should be, it's something to consider in addition to all the other things you're troubleshooting as potential challenges, is to not overlook mycotoxins on the calf and heifer side as well.
Makes sense. Perfect. Okay.
It's time for our famous three.
We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible.
Our Yeast 40 ruminal and intestinal double modulation by ICC Animal Nutrition. Natural Biologics delivers cost-effective solutions to improve health and productivity, helping conquer the rumen health and immunity challenges your animals face. Your partner for extra animal performance, Bergen Schmidt Animal Nutrition. Excellent, a novel product for the management of hypocalcemia. It's uncomplicated excellence. Modern bacteria create biofilms, and biofilm-related issues are at the core of most culling reasons on modern dairy farms. AHV provides the only program for biofilm management in cows and calves. How much of your herd's potential gets choked out by biofilm each year? To learn more, visit www.ahvint.com/QS.
All right, we've got three questions to throw at you. So your first one is, do you have a favorite dairy-related book or resource?
You know, there are several. I hate these types of questions because I'm always hard on myself to narrow down like one single favorite thing. I guess in regards to mycotoxin type resource, I do like the Mycotoxin Blue Book that was edited by Dr. Duarte Diaz. It's got, goes through different species and mycotoxicoses in the various species, but there's other general chapters related to, you know, the molds and what influences them in their production of the toxins, sampling and analyses and mitigation approaches as well. So it's a really good mycotoxin resource in general. So I do appreciate that book. It's actually on my desk, so I use it and reference it still.
That's a good hint. I haven't heard anyone list that one before. Okay.
It's a really good book. Mycotoxin Blue Book.
There we go. There it is.
I'm not a nutritionist, so by training, so, you know, the NRC is great. Obviously there's a lot of those types of resources, but I don't know. I have some other ones that I utilize a lot.
Sounds good. Well, if you look around your shelf, do you have a favorite book or resource that's outside of agriculture?
So my fun reading that I do, I like historical nonfiction. So I like true stories, especially true crime. I actually, I was on the Beef podcast a couple years ago and I admitted that, you know, serial killers and some of the murder type stories are the things that I enjoy reading. So I do like that, but just historical nonfiction in general. Eric Larson is an author that has several books that I like, or Candace Millard has some interesting books that aren't necessarily murder related. They do have some aspect in some of the stories, but I like to read truth, real things, real stories, especially from, you know, Civil War era, the late 1800s. Like, I really enjoy that period. I don't know what it is about it. Sometimes I joke that maybe I was born too late, that I should have been, you know, born and existed in that period. But that's a little insight as to what I like to do in my spare time.
Very cool. Yeah, sometimes I think that too, like it'd be neat to be born back then. And then you think about like modern dentistry and things like that. And like, maybe not.
Yeah, well, the one book by Candace Millard was about the assassination of President James A. Garfield. And he... I'm going to get nerdy on you for a minute with history, but when he was shot, he didn't actually pass away for about 2 months. And so that one is very interesting because it talks about, you know, germ theory and, you know, that was in the 1880s as well. So like they didn't know as much. So had they treated his wounds and dealt with it more hygienically, he probably would have survived. So, you know, that also builds in some of the science and whatnot that I enjoy as well in that story.
Not a fun way to go, to sit there
and fester away for 2 months.
Okay. Maybe on a more positive note, in your opinion, what sets successful dairy professionals apart from those who are less successful?
You know, that's a good question. I think you definitely have to have the drive and the commitment. Persistence maybe is a good term, because we know there's ups and downs in the dairy industry in general. But I think that as a personal attribute is important, because, yeah, I was gloomy about human related things, but sometimes there's bad days on the farm and things that you have to deal with, and you have to, you know, work through that and not let that suck you down and bring you down in general. So I think that persistence and, you know, it is important. And then in a role like myself, I don't get on farm every day. But people come to me as a potential resource looking for information. So I think honesty is huge, because I would like to think I know everything, but I know I don't. So, you know, knowing that I don't know the answer to that, but I'm going to look into it to try to get you a real answer versus, you know, pulling something out of, you know, where, and, you know, giving misinformation. So I am not afraid to say that I don't know something, and I'll, you know, look into it and get back to somebody. So I think that's a really big one too, is, you know, the persistence and the passion to be part of the industry, but then the honesty. And yeah, those are kind of two things I think are important.
Very good. 100% agree. Excellent. Well, Dr. Paige Gott, thanks so much for joining on the Dairy Podcast Show today. It's been a fun conversation.
Yeah, I enjoyed it. Thanks for having me.
So again, this has been another episode of the Dairy Podcast Show. If you haven't followed the show, make sure you hit the button so you don't miss the next episode. And we'll see you then.
To check out the mycotoxin survey provided by DSM Firmenich, visit dsm-firmenich.com/mycotoxin-survey. To sign up for monthly mycotoxin survey updates along with mycotoxin-related articles provided by DSM Firmenich, subscribe here, dsm-firmenich.com/subscribe.